Hey, I'm Jeremy Boone, and you're getting ready to listen to part two of my discussion with author Dan Heath and his book, The Power of Moments. And if you haven't already done so, go back and listen to part one first, as we discuss the first two of Dan's four types of powerful moments that coaches can use when working with your athletes. If you enjoyed the episode, if you enjoy the podcast, do me a favor, help me out, jump on iTunes, leave a review. We've got tens of thousands of coaches who have listened and downloaded two episodes, and we're about 60 or 62 reviews over a period of 4 years. So be a huge help. It helps us spread the word and continue to educate coaches just like you. So that said, let's jump into today's episode.
You're listening to the Coach Your Best podcast with performance coach, motivational speaker, and best-selling author, Jeremy Boone. Brought to you by athletebydesign.com. Today's episode is a conversation designed to help you make your athletes better. Now, here's your host, Jeremy Boone.
Hey, you're listening to the Coach Your Best podcast. I'm your host, Jeremy Boone, and I'd like to welcome back my super co-host, Rhett Larson. Rhett, how are you, brother?
I am wonderful, Jeremy. Happy to be here.
Oh, man, well, listen, you know, part one in our conversation with you, myself, and Dan Heath, where we were talking about the power of moments, was fantastic. We've got just a lot of great feedback, and we talked about really his first two types of moments, where we talked about elevation, we talked about insight. You shared a wonderful story from China, as well as, you know, Dan gave us what I think is one of the best stories in the book around, you know, the sanitation piece in Africa. But give us another defining moment from your end. Last time you shared with us your Mark Verstegen story. So give us maybe a different defining moment this time about something later in your career as a coach.
You know, that actually gives me a good opportunity to bring up what was my first mentor, Lauren Seagrave, who is someone that I've been fortunate enough to see a lot of living out in China. He actually, through the Diamond League sprint events, he comes out to China to train his sprinters and see them in competition in his jumpers. So one of the moments that has stuck with me is seeing Lauren at an event with an elite athlete, something that in all of my time learning under him at Velocity, I never got to see. I just got to see him coaching, but not actually in his element, coaching an elite at an event. Seeing that, I will never forget, because it solidified. And I wasn't just thinking, here is the brilliant coach that I've seen giving all this incredible feedback with a coaching eye that I will never be able to replicate. What I saw and what left an indelible impression was thinking, this is a career that I can do for a long time. You know, I think that if I were to ask my parents, they would think that my career is not going to be physically possible for me once I turn about 50. Watching Lauren Seagrave coach in his 70s is impressive. He is having the time of his life traveling all over the globe. He speaks 13 languages, has 55 million stories that always leave people wanting more. I sat there watching him in Shanghai at a Diamond League event, and I thought, man, that's not a bad little lifestyle. And made me really feel good about this career that we've chosen. That's probably the best later in life moment, aside from specific Olympic ones in my last couple of years.
Yeah,
How about you?
Oh, I love it. You know, I think later in life moments, you get married, you have kids, you know, maybe have some sickness in the family and some unexpected things like that, because they really question your value structure and what matters most, you know, and how does that tie over to the athletes that you work with? If you're a younger coach, you know, defining moments are going to look like athletes that come back 15 years later, you know, and they'll tell you a story about, remember when you said X or when you made me do X, and you're not going to remember it. But that dramatically impacted that athlete for who now they have become as a person. Defining moments are going to come and look like a team you work with all of a sudden loses and the head coach is blaming you and saying this because the athletes aren't strong enough or fast enough, but everybody and all the fans know that's not the case, but you're the scapegoat. That's happened to me a couple of times. I know probably Red, it's happened to you a little bit. Defining moments are going to look like when an athlete that you've busted your tail with and you're sharing the journey with, and you know they're expected to accomplish big things. Well, there's the Olympics, like you read, or I've had an opportunity to, or even just in high school, and then boom, they have a non-contact ACL tear.
Oh yeah.
And you just feel like, oh snap, you know, and you, as a coach, you know, we feel, what could we have done differently? What could we have done more? And we just kind of carry that. And, you know, so we have these highs and these lows of defining moments and journeys and experiences and around the world. I think, you know, Rhett, one for me, honestly, and this is not just to blow smoke up your skirt because I've got you as a co-host, but one of my top five in terms of getting to travel international and how they shaped me is getting to come to China, was it 2 years ago now? And getting to experience China through your eyes was incredible for me because, you know, environments pull us. They don't push us always. And to see how you worked hard to adapt, get to know the language, develop relationships, overcome language barriers. Those are all big, important things and skill sets that coaches have to have. And so just watching you do that in your element and getting to add value was phenomenal. And then the next day getting to spend with Sun Wen, who you and I both know. We know she's the former captain of the women's Chinese national soccer team. FIFA names her co-player of the century, but just to be with her in China, in her country, for an entire day and see her country and her culture through her eyes definitely challenged me to come back with the athletes that I get to work with here. So all great stuff, right?
Absolutely. And I hope that's all just not some code for you saying that I'm gotten shorter, but I do appreciate it. That was a lot of fun having you out there.
Well, you know, you are getting ready to head back to China. Mm-hmm. And I know you're excited about working with athletes there. So we want to kind of take an opportunity to go in here to part two. And we're going to talk about the next two types of moments in our discussion. And for those listening, you're going to hear us talking about the moments of pride and the moments of connection. And I know, Rhett, you felt pretty strongly about the Disneyland example and how Dan talks about that and keeping players motivated. Kind of talk us a little bit about your thought process around those types of moments as we jump into our conversation with Dan.
Yeah, I think the Disneyland example is a good reminder that it's always important to keep hitting on the positives that are coming out of training. You know, there's going to be no shortage of brain power in your athletes that is spent on the little things that they're screwing up. It's important that you give them a feel for the big picture. If you have to do that with metrics, if you're able to do that with metrics to show them the steady, slow climb of a bar graph, that's important because they need to remember the big Disney picture and not the long lines that they're waiting in the grueling sunshine of Orlando. They don't need to remember the toughest parts of training. You got to keep it in the front of their brain how much progress they're making and how much fun they're having.
So the book is called The Power of Moments by Chip and Dan Heath. Rhett, let's jump into the conversation between me, you, and Dan Heath. Let's go. You know, both of those are great stories around one of your elements of the moments of insight. And I think Rhett and I both agree that the most effective and impactful coaches play in that space. And the third element you have, Dan, in your book talks about the moments of pride. And this is where I see that many coaches spend a lot of their time, because the pride of winning, the pride of ego. And, you know, we're in this world right now where the cliche of everything has to be a grind. And on page 140, you have a brilliant quote that now I have got up in three or four places with athletes that says, "Hard work is essential, but it doesn't guarantee that we'll experience defining moments." And that comes in your chapter of the importance of recognizing others. So talk to us a little bit about why is that so important to recognize others and the opportunity of moments of pride.
Yeah, recognition was something I'm embarrassed to say was not part of our original vision for the book. I'm kind of embarrassed about it now, but we started asking people about defining moments in their work. And we would get these responses back that didn't seem that grand. You know, I think I was expecting people to come back with these, you know, capital D dramatic stories of, you know, I closed the $1 million account or whatever. And instead we got things like this. This is an actual example from one of our surveys. I was greatly commended by my manager for prepping the back room by cleaning and reorganizing all the bikes for easy scanning for inventory. I felt proud that someone actually took the time to acknowledge my effort. And so again and again, it was like these small things, people noticing something they had done and praising them for it. And they were citing these as some of the defining moments in their career for the past few years. And so we quickly caught on that moments of recognition are special because they seem really ordinary to the person doing the recognizing, and they feel extraordinary to the people receiving it. I was just at a board meeting yesterday, and some people were telling stories about their mentors and things that their mentors had said. And I'm talking, you know, 30, 40 years ago, and how those comments, you know, just little bits of praise or little bits of constructive criticism actually changed their life for the better. And a couple of them said, you know, they had run into their mentors years later and had told them, hey, you know, this moment really made a difference for me. And the mentors didn't even remember. And I don't say that to pick on the mentors. I think the point is that there's kind of this giant magnifying effect. There's this, you know, huge megaphone that happens between the person that's doing the recognizing and the recipient of the recognition. And boy, if you're a coach listening to this, you need to be aware of that you have this kind of insane power you may not have even realized, that, you know, in those moments when you take someone aside and say, hey, you know, really impressed at the way you've been working on this, or, you know, I really admire the way you bounce back from such and such. You know, a week later, you may forget saying that, but the person doesn't. And in fact, it may be something they remember a decade or two later.
You know, what I like about that example, Dan, is often what Rhett and I have talked about many, many times in this idea of recognizing others. And there's two other areas where I think the world of sports, both sports in general and coaches struggle. One is, you know, in the weight room, athletes typically get recognized by their bench, their squat, their deadlift, their clean. But usually it's the same athletes that dominate that week in and week out. So you leave 90% of the kids that don't have that. And that tends to be a struggle in that space. And then the other space is this whole idea in the United States, and I'm sure you've heard of it, is the recognition that every kid gets a trophy. And I think it's real important to bring up those two points, because I don't hear you talking about either of those two strategies as reasons for recognizing others. Rhett, would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm really interested to hear Dan talk about this. I have an idea of a sweet spot in the middle for coaches, but my idea came to me as I was listening actually to him talk about the Disney experience, whereas I think coaches miss out when they just do all of their testing on maybe their four big key lifts, and they do them just one, you know, at the beginning and then at the end. I think that in that huge gap of training in between, you miss the experience of having everybody having the ability to set PRs over and over again. That even if you love a squat, that every once in a while you need to change it up to you know, a squat with bands, so that you enabled everybody else to get a PR with bands. And then the next month you need to change up that squat to be a goblet squat, so you enable everybody to get their PR. And you need to manufacture reasons for everyone on the team to celebrate, not just the huge kid that has his name up on the Wall of Fame 14 times.
Right. Yeah. So Dan, what do you think? What would you say to that?
Yeah, I have two thoughts. One is, number one, I think we have to be careful what we recognize, especially in the kind of formal sense of, you know, having a scoreboard somewhere. And you see this all the time in the business world. Like, I remember there was one example of AT&T at one point was worried they weren't getting enough productivity out of their programmers, and so they started paying by the line. And of course, what does that create? It creates programs that are, you know, far too long for what they need to be because people are responding to the incentive. And so it's like a formal recognition program is going to give you a lot more of what you're incentivizing. But as a coach, you got to be careful that it's correlating with what you want it to correlate with. Like my wife is a physical therapist, and so we hang out with a lot of her friends who are sports PTs and working with, basketball players at Duke and elsewhere. And I know a lot of what's going on these days is, you know, is more in the vein of injury prevention. So it's like if you're calling a lot of attention to something like bench press, does that really correlate with stamina and performance and lack of injuries? And that's something I know nothing about. So I'll trust you and your listeners to negotiate that. But I guess the first point is be careful what you recognize. And then the second point that every kid gets a trophy thing, I think that's an easy thing to mock. I think the spirit is right. I mean, clearly you want everybody who participates in sports to be glad they participated and to be able to feel some pride from having participated, even when they lost. I think the trophy thing in particular is just a bad solution because it kind of mixes metaphors. Like trophies are what we give to people who win. That's the whole point of a trophy. And so it's like we dilute the pride of winning by giving it to everyone. But that's not the same thing as saying, you know, the loser should suffer and that's the way it should be. I don't think the loser should suffer, but it goes back to what you said earlier about redefining winning. And I think a win, especially in, you know, youth sports where it's not about a career, it's not about constant excellence. A win is really about, you know, I tried something, I stretched myself, and that feels good. It feels good to have grown a little bit, even if I didn't win in this particular game.
Yeah. You know, as you were talking, I kept on thinking that it would be so important for a youth sport coach to spend some time thinking about what every athlete's best thing that they do on the basketball court is, because it is that one moment of taking a kid aside and saying, I can't believe how much better you've gotten at dribbling with your left hand, making free throws. That one individual, that is possibly the moment that keeps that kid in basketball, that makes that kid bond with that coach forever.
Well, and the cool thing about youth sports is, you know, the growth rates and skill rates, they happen so fast that it's like every kid could have a moment like that. Like one thing Chip and I were talking about is one of the compelling things about sports is that they offer so many natural moments of pride. You know, every time you win a game, that's a moment of pride. Every time, you know, you score 20 points in a basketball game, that's a moment of pride. And so they're just, that's what people love about sports. At the same time, you know, you would like to be able to deliver those moments to every single kid that plays, even if they ended up on an 0-10 team. And so one thing I would suggest is, I mean, imagine if you had a video of the first day you did wind sprints in practice and everybody is just dying, you know, and the one guy pukes in the corner and then you show the same drill 3 months later after they're in shape. Just the kind of tangible, visible evidence that, hey, like we've come a long way just physically. And then you could also do things like what you just described, you know, show the kid who comes in and he can't dribble with his left hand to save his life. And then 3 months later, like he's doing it great. He doesn't even have to look anymore. And that kid, even if he's been on a terrible team, is still going to get a huge boost just from seeing like, hey, I've gotten a lot better at this. This is kind of cool to feel like you can build your skills at something just with some effort. And so that's an example of how we can actually create moments of pride, you know, knowing that sports has a natural rhythm that delivers moments of pride and wins and losses and points scored and so forth. But as a coach, you can go beyond that and look for moments of pride that correspond to growth.
Gosh, such good stuff, Dan. I know Red and I could sit here and talk with you for 2, 3, 4 more hours, and the listeners would be engaged in. And we've got a couple minutes left. I'd like to just hit on 2 or 3 final points to wrap us up, at least for today. And, you know, you talk in your book an entire chapter about this idea of creating shared meaning and looking at laughter and fun versus humor. And I know, you know, Rhett and I always like to try to build that in, and that looks differently for different groups of people where, you know, in the beginning, maybe for a warm-up, we're doing stuff with balloons and shaving cream and before we actually go in and work, or where, you know, there's a little great video of Rhett, and actually, Rhett, with your permission, maybe we'll snag it and put it up in the blog post notes, and Dan will show it to you because you'll love it. There's a great video of the women's Chinese volleyball team warming up, and they've got this hilarious music in the background, and Rhett's going to every player, and he has like his own little way of giving them high five or pointing at them, and Rhett's dancing around, and I mean, and that's kind of what he probably looks like on the dance floor too, but he is working it. And, you know, talk to the listeners, especially those younger coaches, you know, in their 20s that are listening, that are so dialed in into digital relationships. You know, everything is, you know, you can be standing 5 feet away and the coach is going to text their athlete saying, how you doing today? Talk to us about that importance of creating shared meaning when it comes to the power of moments.
Yeah, two observations. One is, you know, we've talked a lot on this episode about positive moments and happy moments, and I don't want to underplay the value of some struggle. You know, that that what we know about what bonds groups together is that they've often struggled on something that was important to all of them, something that was hard. You know, if you think about boot camp as kind of the quintessential example of a group of people from all over the country, you know, different races, different religions, different interests, you know, no chance that they would become friends naturally in the real world. And then you put them together, you give them these impossible missions, and you push them to the limits of their endurance. And all of a sudden they come out, and that's a bond for life. I mean, they could go 20 years without seeing another person and from that experience and still be bonded. And it's because of the struggle. So, you know, don't mistake what we're saying as, you know, it needs to be a nonstop laugh fest, you know, that the struggle is the thing. The effort to get better and to share that with other people is what links groups together. And what I'll add to that is that doesn't mean the struggle is joyless, that even groups that are struggling together kind of develop their own inside jokes and maybe some gallows humor. And we cite a study in the book that I think is kind of fun to think about. This researcher named Robert Provin and some assistants, they just walked around some city sidewalks and some college campuses, and they eavesdropped on people's conversations. And when someone in those conversations laughed, they jotted down what was said just before the laugh. And what they found was that fewer than 20% of the comments that sparked the laughter were even remotely funny. You know, so, you know, you might think we're going to hear some stand-up style jokes, but really it was comments like, are you sure? It was nice meeting you too. And my favorite example they wrote down was, look, it's Andre. You know, that is not a laugh riot, those things. And yet they were drawing chuckles. And so what this researcher concluded is that laughter is not really about what's funny. It's really a social reaction. That laughter is more about relationships than it is about humor. And what our laughter is saying is basically like, I'm with you. You know, I'm in your club. I'm part of your group. And so in a way, laughter is a good diagnostic that you've got a team that's clicking. You know, if you hear a lot of laughter among your team, what it means is it's working. You know, they feel like they're part of the same club. They feel like they're part of the same group. Even if they're saying nothing that resembles anything we might call humor.
When you said that, I can't help but think of some of the training ways some of the training methods I have in my own program that I stick in there really because, well, not entirely, but a lot because it bonds my team together. I put my volleyball players in cold bathtubs the research on cold immersion isn't awesome. But what I do know is that the girls bond in the
right.
There's no doubt about it. There is mutual suffering and laughing and screaming and hand holding. And it's impactful in that way. In the same way that long hold putting somebody in push-up position, having them hold it for 2 minutes or wall sits. I don't know that that's the best use of my time, but I do know that the girls bond in that suffering and laughing and are you dying? That they're parts of what you just said that can have an impact on a coach.
But I love how you found ways to combine the struggle aspect and the laughter aspect all at once. I think that's genius.
We're about wrapped up with time with you, Dan. I think kind of final big question, at least for today, for this amazing conversation. You know, it's one that you talk about towards the end of the book and the difference between passion and purpose. And a lot of young coaches who think that coaching is really their calling and they tend to say, you know, I have a passion for coaching and that's what I'm going to do. You know, so what would you have to say relative to that part of your book where the question comes up, should coaches follow their passion or follow their purpose?
There's some really interesting research done by a guy named Morten Hansen on this topic. He just wrote a book that came out called Great at Work. And what he did was he did this huge study of employees. And he had them answer a bunch of questions that would assess how was their passion level for the work they were doing. And also, independently, how was their purpose level. And just to say a quick word about the distinction there, passion is kind of in the sense of your excitement level, like you're enthusiastic about your work, and purpose is more about the feeling that you're contributing to someone else, that your work has broader meaning. And so what he did was he had people self-assess to see, you know, were they high purpose or low purpose, were they high passion or low passion, and then he had their supervisors rank how good of an employee they were. And what he found was, you know, some is pretty obvious. When people were both high purpose and passion, they were really, really good employees. When they were low on both, they were really, really bad. That's not too surprising. But what he found was if you were only high on one, passion or purpose, you were a far more talented employee if you were high purpose. And that's a little surprising because we're kind of taught to glorify passion. But the logic was that purpose is what keeps you going. You know, in the tough times and when it's not fun that day, you know, when you don't feel a natural sense of enthusiasm that day, purpose is what keeps you going. And so I think the best answer is try to have both. Try to find work that you feel like is both a calling and fun for you. But if you have to choose the calling, choose the purpose.
Choose the calling, choose the purpose. Dan, we would like to... just grateful for your time, brother, and if we wrap this conversation up, we want to make sure that our listeners have at least a first step of action because there's so much information. What would you have as really the advice for the best first step that a listener can take in their efforts to be intentional about engineering defining moments?
Very simple. It's something you can do literally today. You know, take somebody on your team aside, somebody you're coaching, and notice them, you know, point out something they've done that you think is commendable. Tell them that, you know, eye to eye, make a big deal about it, and then keep going about your day. And it's going to take you about 3 minutes and it's going to feel really good. And it, with a little bit of luck, that comment might be something that lifts that young person up, and it may even be something they're remembering 25 years from now. A little bit of effort can often have a disproportionate return.
Well, the book is The Power of Moments by author Dan Heath and his brother Chip Heath, and just been a delightful conversation with the both of you. Dan, thank you for your time. Rhett, thank you for your time. Dan, where can the listeners go to find out more about your work?
They can come check us out at heathbrothers.com, and you'll find about all of our books. And there's also a lot of free goodies on our site as well, podcasts and workbooks and resources and so forth. So check it out.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Been a wonderful conversation.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks.
This has been another episode of the Coach Your Best podcast with Jeremy Boone. Get even more helpful tips and free coaching resources to help you become a world-class coach by visiting athletebydesign.com.